This is KZSU, Stanford. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions. We're coming to you from the Stanford campus. The song is Black Cat from the album Acquiring the Taste by our old friends Gentle Giant. I chose the song because our show today deals with the Polish-American poet, essayist, and Nobel laureate Czesław Miłosz, and I happened upon a remarkable cat poem of his, which I thought I would read aloud in English to give you a taste of what kind of poet we will be talking about in the next hour with my guest. From what I'm able to gather, it's addressed to someone who had just published an essay titled Against Cruelty. The poem goes by the title To Mrs. Professor in Defense of My Cat's Honor and Not Only. Here we go. My valiant helper, a small-sized tiger, sleeps sweetly on my desk by the computer, unaware that you insult his tribe. Cats play with a mouse or with a half-dead mole. You are wrong, though. It's not out of cruelty. They simply like a thing that moves. For after all, we know that only consciousness can for a moment move into the other, empathize with the pain and panic of a mouse. And such as cats are, all of nature is, indifferent, alas, to the good and the evil. Quite a problem for us, I am afraid. Natural history has its museums, but why should our children learn about monsters, an earth of snakes and reptiles for millions of years? Nature devouring, nature devoured, butchery day and night, smoking with blood. And who created it? Was it the good Lord? Yes, undoubtedly they are innocent. Spiders, mantises, sharks, pythons. We are the only ones who say cruelty. Our consciousness and our conscience alone in the pale anthill of galaxies put their hope in a humane God, who cannot but feel and think, who is kindred to us by his warmth and movement, for we are, as he told us, similar to him. Yet, if it is so, and he takes pity on every mauled mouse, every wounded bird, then the universe for him is like a crucifixion. Such is the outcome of your attack on the cat, a theological Augustinian grimace which makes difficult our walking on this earth. So from a house cat sleeping near a computer to the amoral order of nature to the crucifixion of the universe, that's Czesław Miłosz condensing into a handful of verses the kind of thinking that only poets are capable of. And speaking of thinking, Darwin wrote somewhere that the suffering of the lower animals throughout time was more than he could bear to think of. In his letter to the Romans, St. Paul wrote of the malaise of the earth as a whole, declaring, "The whole creation has been groaning in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time." Maybe paradise is open to all of God's creatures, as Pope Francis reportedly told a distraught boy whose dog had just died. It's an edifying thought, but one that I suspect Miłosz would respond to by saying, "It should be so, even if it isn't so." He was intensely aware, was Miłosz, that in its indifference, alas, to the good and the evil, nature invariably has a way of flummoxing our human ideas of justice and our human longing for justice. My guest today is Cynthia Haven, a literary scholar, critic, Slavicist, and journalist. She's written for a wide range of publications, including the TLS, the Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times, the New York Times Book Review. She's a National Endowment for the Humanities public scholar, and she studied with Joseph Brodsky and has won many literary and journalistic awards. She's also the author of many excellent books, among them Evolution of Desire, A Life of René Girard, a frequent guest on this program in the earliest years when we launched back in 2005. Also, Joseph Brodsky, Conversations, Czesław Miłosz, Conversations, and most recently, Czesław Miłosz, A California Life, which came out with Heyday Press up here in Berkeley, a really excellent press, in 2021. I'll also mention that Cynthia Haven runs the best literary blog in the blogosphere. It's called The Book Haven, and all of you literary-minded listeners out there will want to check that out, The Book Haven. Cynthia, welcome to Entitled Opinions.
Thank you, Robert. Pleasure to be here.
You spent several years researching and writing your recent biography of Milos. So I'd like to know, first off, what was it that drew you to him in the first place and inspired you to devote so much of your time to writing a biography of his California life, as you call it?
Well, as you mentioned, I had been a student of Joseph Brodsky's. I studied with him. A few years after his death, I was rereading some of his essays, and I came across a recommendation of Czesław Miłosz that he made as perhaps the greatest poet of our time. I'll read the statement in full. This was a statement to the 1978 Neustadt jury, which, as one knows, the Neustadt Award is a precursor for the Nobel. And it was in this case, because Miłosz got the Nobel 2 years later, and this was the Joseph Brodsky recommendation, quote, "I have no hesitation whatsoever in stating that Czesław Miłosz is one of the greatest poets of our time, perhaps the greatest. Even if one strips his poems of the stylistic magnificence of his native Polish, which is what translation inevitably does, and reduces them to the naked subject matter, we still find ourselves confronting a severe and relentless mind of such intensity that the only parallel one is able to think of is that of the biblical characters, most likely Job." Well, that was a wow. I immediately began to look him up and try to find out more about him, and I found out he lived across the bay from me. I'm in Palo Alto. He was across the bay in Berkeley, where he had lived 40 years. Actually, that's more years than any other place he spent in his life, hence the focus of my book. We think of California as an interlude, but he spent more time there than in Poland or Lithuania or really anywhere else. Anyway, I tried to arrange an interview with him. Since I was a literary journalist, I thought this was a way of getting to know him, as it had been for so many other people that I studied and wrote about. It wasn't easy. He was 89. He was about to turn 89. It was near his birthday. And he wasn't giving interviews anymore. So I began talking to his assistant. I mentioned Joseph Brodsky as my carte d'entrée. And it took 6 months, but I got an interview with him. We spoke for several hours up on Grizzly Peak in his living room. After that, I asked if I could come back, and he granted a second interview. It was a month later because I had a trip to Egypt in between. And our second interview, I thought things went well, and that would be the beginning of a relationship, but that turned out not to be the case. He went back to Poland for his regular visit every year. His health declined, and he never returned to Berkeley. So that's the way I got to be the last journalist to interview him in America.
Were you able to accumulate enough information and insights in your two meetings with him to feed your biography of his California life?
I use those excerpts from that interview a lot. I have a 7,000-word transcript. It was excerpted for the Georgia Review. It became the basis of a study, a lifelong, or at least for me, 20 years study now, of him. I was, at that point, he was publishing a treatise on poetry for the first time in English. This is the time lapse we experienced with Miłosz. There was a 50-year lapse between the writing of that great poem shortly after the war.
Which poem is this?
It's a book-length poem called, short book-length book poem called A Treatise on Poetry. And
it's a poem or a treatise?
It's a treatise in poetry.
I got it. Treatise in verse. Got it.
And it was the first book of his that I'd read.
And it convinced you that he was indeed worthy of those hyperboles that Joseph Brodsky had written down?
It convinced me that I was stepping into a very deep river. And it was just the beginning of my exploration. And it would go on for 20 years without cessation. I'm still exploring. It's still unfinished. He's endless.
And are you as devoted to him and his oeuvre as you are and were to Brodsky's? Because you've done a lot for Brodsky as well.
They're such different minds and such different people. I keep coming back to what his publisher said to me. He said that he referred to the continent Miwosh, and I really feel like it's a world. And you can see the fullness of Miwosh's knowledge. He never tired. He was never bored by anything. There are all these stories about him. I'll tell a story that Robert Haas told me. One day he came into Miwosh's house, and Miwosh was reading a book about women's underwear in the late 19th century, a sort of catalog. And Robert Haas said, "What are you reading that for?" And he said he wanted to identify what was hanging on the clotheslines when he was a boy in Lithuania. He was endlessly curious. He wanted to know anything. This is another story I love. He had been born in Lithuania and, of course, became a Polish poet. But because he was part of the Polish-speaking gentry, he had never actually learned Lithuanian. And he was starting to learn it in his 80s. And Robert Haas said, "Why are you bothering to learn Lithuanian now?" And he said, "Because I think it may be the language of heaven."
Do we know why he said that? Is it? I don't know Lithuanian. Is it particularly melodious and angelic or what?
He didn't specify.
All right.
But it was the language he heard growing up, and perhaps that was enough. He very much idealized his Lithuanian childhood.
Yeah. So he is, as you call him, a world or a planet, more than even a continent. That's presumably because he was many things. He was a poet. He was an essayist. He was a diplomat. I mean, he had a career as a diplomat for a while. He had lived through all the major events and disasters of the 20th century, and was born before the beginning of World War I. Let's face it, he was born in 1911, lived through that war, and then through the Communist Revolution in Russia, and then the Second World War, and the Holocaust, and Stalinism. And in that respect, his biography, it really spans an entire century. He's a poet, as essayist. He also, wrote an important book about totalitarianism and the psychology of totalitarianism. So I understand that he is extremely multidimensional. And was that your ambition in your biography, is to show just how all these different aspects of one individual life came together in one man?
That was a temptation I had to avoid. I wanted to look at him from a California perspective. There's already been a masterful biography by Andrei Pirfenacek, which has been translated into English, Princeton University Press. I had to resist the temptation to write a 500-page book. I wanted to keep in mind what he brought to us in California and what we brought to him.
And what did he bring to California? What did California give him?
Well, the most obvious thing, California gave him a place where he could write in peace and have a job. You have to understand, he described Polish as an unheard of tongue in one of his poems. There was no cache of Polish translators. There was not a community that he could plug into. He solved that problem by, in his classroom, training a generation of Polish translators, people like Claire Kavanaugh, people like Richard Lurie, Bob Haas, Robert Pinsky. All of these people brought what we call the sort of Polish flowering in the 20th century of literature was because of his efforts. Mm-hmm. He made that happen. The first tasks he took on in California were writing the books Postwar Polish Poetry, which introduced people like Zbigniew Herbert, Wisława Szymborska, Tadeusz Wasiewicz, all these major figures. He brought them into English. He and Peter Dale Scott of Berkeley, did the first selected poems for Zbigniew Herbert. His History of Polish Literature, which is a 600-page book, has been called a textbook that can be read for fun. He introduced Polish culture, its literature, into the American and into the Western world in English.
What year does he arrive in California?
1960. He got an invitation out of the blue.
So most of his major work was written in California then?
Yes.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
It is remarkable. Yeah. And it's something that goes so it's so overlooked.
I'm astonished because his sensibility, the experience of the Holocaust, the war, the destruction of Warsaw, and all this horribly dark history that he was a witness to, and his metaphysical sensibilities and his intense awareness of the tragic disconnect between nature's amoral order and our human demand for justice, as I mentioned in my introductory remarks, that California seems like the antithesis of someone who understands the shadows and the darkness and the night world of human tragedy and disaster. And here he finds himself in a state of, you know, the Golden State with its the clearness of the view, the openness and the belief in the future and the kind of New Age attitudes. It's quite astonishing that he did so much creative work in this state of ours.
We had peace. He was up on Grizzly Peak. He was basically given carte blanche by Berkeley to do what he wanted. And that was the reason for the astonishing productivity.
Yeah, but I was reading a poem that you brought my attention to. I think it's about a California... Is it a Magic Mountain? Is the California poem?
Yeah. Yes, it is. Now, that's early poem. That's 1973.
73, but he seems very ironic about California.
I mean, yes.
He did not embrace California just without ambiguity.
Oh, a great deal of ambiguity. Do you want to read that one?
It's a bit long, so maybe we'll hold off before we read it. And let's just, if you don't mind, if he arrived in the 60s, a number of important things happened before he arrived and after the war, where he becomes a diplomat, correct? And he is sent to Washington, I believe, or New York to Washington. This is in the late 40s.
This was right after the war.
Right after the war.
He was standing on the ruins of Warsaw. Men were unemployed. There were no jobs. The only jobs were government jobs, pretty much. So he has been criticized, most recently by Ann Applebaum, for taking a government job in the Stalinist government. But as his son said, he got a job. He was a cultural attaché, which is the lowest-ranking appointment in the diplomatic corps. And he got to go abroad. Zbigniew Herbert was fighting much of his life to get that privilege. Miłosz got it off the bat by being a diplomat. He arranged cultural exchanges and that sort of thing. He was sent to New York City, which, of course, is especially then the literary capital of the U.S. He made many friends. We make the argument in my book that he actually probably met W.H. Auden. He was a good friend with Thornton Wilder, who helped him a great deal after he defected. It was a playground. He went to the Bread Loaf Conference. He translated Negro spirituals. Mm-hmm. Then he was transferred to Washington. At that point, Poland, communism was coming down with a stronger hand, with a lot of electoral developments in Poland, and it was a government job, much more boring. He got moved to France and was a diplomat there.
And that's when he defects.
That's when he defects.
And why did he decide to defect?
There is an amazing story he tells where he was going back to Poland for a visit. He was coming from a government party, probably tuxedo, everything else. And as he was driving home, probably half drunk, if not more, he saw a truck of people being taken away by the government for questioning or whatever was going to be doing to them, shivering, even though it was a summer night, it was cold. As he was all dressed up and partying on the government's dime, he was watching the people being taken away to nobody knows where. And he said that night he realized what he had been a part of. I doubt it was the first time it occurred to him, but it struck home in an important way. Shortly after that, the government in Poland, while he was there, took away his passport. That was a sign that he was about to be arrested. He managed to finagle his passport back enough to get back to France. And that's when he knew he had to make a move and defect. One morning, February 1st, 1951, he went onto the street laden with suitcases and took a taxi to the outskirts of Paris. That's where Maison Lafitte had an important émigré community, now legendary for its publications and its maintenance of Polish culture in France during that time of when France was Stalinist. In the subsequent few months, he was self-doubting. He wasn't sure he'd done the right thing. He was drinking too much, pacing up and down, and arguing with the people and making himself a nuisance in Maison Lafitte. He was told not to appear in front of windows. It was that dangerous. He could be kidnapped. And in those tormented months, he wrote the book, Captive Mind, which is an exhalation of grief and recognition of what happens to the mind under totalitarianism.
Is it in the captive mind that he recounts the figure of swallowing frogs?
After his defection, he was the first defector from the communist government to give a press conference and to give the reasons for his defection. And he said the paramount role of a poet is to tell the truth. He compared communism to the process of swallowing frogs. You might be able to get one down, perhaps even a second, but at the third frog, it's not the revolt of the mind or the feelings, it's a revolt of the stomach.
This actually compromised his friendships and relations with a number of French intellectuals who were very pro-Stalinist at this point, right?
The intelligentsia of France was pretty universally Stalinist. Pablo Neruda had been a friend. He was a cultural attaché from Chile, similar position, a communist, wrote an essay about him called The Man Who Ran Away. That hurt on a lot of levels. All his friends deserted him, with the powerful exception of Albert Camus.
Yeah, well, Camus, you can always count on Camus to come through for you. So he defects, he's separated from his family. I think his wife is at this point back in Poland or in America or somewhere, no?
His wife was in Washington, D.C., where they had lived together when he was as a cultural attaché. His reappointment to France, they had not had a time to bring her over yet. So yes, he was separated from his wife, his oldest son, and also his wife was pregnant. She had had a very difficult first pregnancy, and she was strongly advised not to go anywhere by her doctors. And the second birth was a traumatic one.
How does he end up in California, Cynthia? Where did that offer to go to California come from?
He won a major literary award, which turned around his finances somewhat in Europe, a major European award. He got an offer out of the blue from Berkeley. He turned them down the first time in 1959, but the offer was renewed, and he came to California in 1960.
Yeah, okay, so he publishes The Bells in Winter in 1978. He gets the Nobel Prize in 1980. And then he remains in California until, as you said, until 81, when the Solidarity movement in Poland had loosened things up. And he goes back and forth between Poland and California for the next couple of decades, right?
Well, it was a remarkable experience to him. He didn't know he had an audience in Poland. He thought nobody read him because he was basically a forbidden writer. And within days of his return to Poland, the presses were running, and I think there was 100,000 copies of his first book that sold out immediately. He was cheered in the streets. People were following him, and there were still a good number of his old friends from Poland that he could meet. He had a brother in Poland. He knew some of that, but as Helen Vendler put it, he didn't know because he hadn't seen. He thought that he had no reputation in Poland at all, and suddenly he was a hero being followed and mobbed in the streets.
Yeah, it takes an old world country to exalt poets. A good old country like Poland. Imagine the homecoming of an American poet. It would go without a ripple. Anyway.
Well, I attended his 2000 poetry reading in Berkeley. It was the last reading he gave. It was during the time I interviewed him. And I have to say, I had never seen a poetry reading like that. People were crowding to get into the hall in Berkeley. I think it's, I've forgotten the name of the hall. It was, people were hanging from the balustrades. People were, it was like a rock star. I understand that that's a fraction of what he got in Poland, but it was more than I'd ever seen for a poetry reading in America.
Right. Yeah. Well, Nobel Prize will do wonders for your attendance.
Plus being a homeboy.
Yes, exactly. Do you think that he did his best work as a writer in California?
It's so hard to judge it accurately, isn't it? Because the bulk of his work was here, and this is something that people forget. He wrote remarkable poems about our people, our country, our landscapes.
Is there one you would like to read?
Well, we've spoken so much about suffering. He went through an enormous suffering in his life, the death of his first wife, later everything else. What bothers me when we talk about Miłosz, when I try to bring him to people, I mention the name and their faces fall and they say, oh, poet of witness, Holocaust, destruction of Warsaw. But he was also a poet of the miraculous. He was a poet of wonder. And as I've argued, he was the best poet of old age we've had since Walt Whitman. Anyway, here's a late life poem that shows some of that. It's called Awakened. It's not a poem, actually. It's a short prose, but I don't think you could call it a prose poem. But anyway, here it is. In advanced age, my health worsening, I woke up in the middle of the night and experienced a feeling of happiness so intense and perfect that in all my life I had only felt its premonition. And there was no reason for it. It didn't obliterate consciousness. The past which I carried was there, together with my grief, and it was suddenly included, was a necessary part of the whole. As if a voice were repeating, you can stop worrying now. Everything happened just as it had to. You did what was assigned to you, and you are not required anymore to think of what happened long ago. The peace I felt was a closing of accounts and was connected with the thought of death. The happiness on this side was like an announcement of the other side. I realized that this was an undeserved gift, and I could not grasp by what grace it was bestowed on me.
That's a poem that Nietzsche would call Amor Fati, the love of one's fate, whatever fate has bestowed on you.
I like that.
You accept it with a certain kind of love, yeah. That's a, you know, a very, it's a very promising poem. It's a promise that maybe on the other side there is you know, some kind of redemption. Often there are other poems in which he despairs of any sort of redemption. So Theodicy, for example, is a poem that doesn't have nearly the same sort of opening into the miraculous, as you call it. And let me see what he says there so that our listeners can get a sense of the other side. No, it won't do, my sweet theologians. Desire will not save the morality of God. if he created beings able to choose between good and evil, and they chose, and the world lies in iniquity, nevertheless, there is pain and the undeserved torture of creatures, which would find its explanation only by assuming the existence of an archetypal paradise and a pre-human downfall so grave that the world of matter received its shape from diabolical power. That's a modern-day version of Manichaeanism and the idea that the world that we inhabit is engendered and in the possession of demonic powers, diabolical powers, yeah. We should have read Awaken after Theodicy because it gives us a much more forceful last word, I would say. No?
Well, Theodicy is one of his poems where he plays with various heresies.
Right. And this idea that the existence of an archetypal paradise is the notion that I mentioned at the beginning where Pope Francis is reportedly to have said to a boy that paradise is open to all of God's creatures. I don't know. Apparently he may not have said that in exactly those words, but I think Milos would have understood exactly what the Pope had in mind, no?
Yes. I think one of the heresies that he liked playing with the most, I think that's most appealing to us, is apokatastasis, which is a notion that's in the writings of Origen, that all will be saved and everything will be restored. All of creation will be renewed at the end of time.
And how Catholic was he, ultimately? He was born Catholic, but he certainly was not Orthodox in any...
Yes, he was not Orthodox. And yet, I spoke with someone who remembers seeing him at St. Mary Magdalene in Berkeley after Vatican II and kneeling on the floor in prayer, rejecting the kneeler and having his knees on the stone ground or the floor or whatever it was. Leonard Nathan, who was a friend of his and a colleague at Berkeley, reviewed one of his books and met him in the library and said, I really enjoyed your poems. I reviewed them. But I have to say, you know, I question some of your poems. You really play with some heresies here. And Miłosz leaned over and said, and how do you think I feel as a practicing Catholic?
Exactly, yeah. So we fast forward a little bit to his... I'm curious, is he buried in Warsaw?
Krakow.
At okay.
Peter on the Rock.
So he spent his last years, the last years of his life in Poland.
Yes, in desire, and also he was a health exile. His health became fragile. The only time he returned after 2000, when I met him, was when his second wife, his beloved second wife, an American second wife, very American, he was brought into a southern family and was very close to the Thigpen family of Atlanta, suddenly became ill. She was a very healthy woman, had never been ill in her life. And in desperation to save her, they flew her back to California. And when he got word she was dying, he was not in condition to fly, but nonetheless, he was told, if you want to see your wife for a last time, this is your opportunity. So that was his last time in California. And perhaps as a last time left a sort of bitter taste in his mouth to lose a woman he had loved so much.
After that, he went back to Poland.
That's where he died. He was writing poems to the last few days of his life, according to a woman who was helping him and assisting him at that time. She said he was waking up in the morning in the hospital with poems in his head.
I'm assuming that he had what amounted to a national funeral. Is that correct?
It was a national funeral, and there were demonstrations.
Pro and con?
He was always controversial, and he didn't quite fit in anywhere. There were people protesting that he should not be given a state funeral because he was not actually Polish. He was Lithuanian. There were people that were saying that he should not have a Catholic funeral because he wasn't properly Catholic. He played with too many heresies. And it was only resolved with a letter from the Pope saying that he'd been in communication with Miłosz and he had told him that he was a proper Catholic.
That he got
the unconventional, right, but proper Catholic.
He got the benediction.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Good for him. May he rest in peace.
At one point, the Pope came to him and said, I don't understand what you're doing with your religion. You come one step forward, and then you go one step backward. You go two steps forward, and then one. And Miłosz said, is there any other way to write about religion in the 20th century?
Yeah, or 21st century.
21st century, especially, by that point.
Yeah, exactly.
21st century.
All right. All very interesting. So I think, Cynthia, you've been an ambassador for Czesław Miłosz in a way that I think our listeners are going to want to go and read him for themselves, both his poetry as well as his, even his political writings. Captive Mind is still in print and well worth the read.
And we've only scratched the surface.
Yes. And going deeper into the under the surface, your book about A California Life, published by Heyday Press just this last year, is an excellent place to start. So
I hope so. That's what I wanted it to be.
All right.
Because it's a world and you need to have some entry point.
Thanks again for coming on to Entitled Opinion, Cynthia.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions. Bye-bye. Get on, get on, get on.